The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Hello and welcome to the Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly and the show focuses on integrative medicine for cancer, which means I talk to everyone from researchers and scientists to practitioners, doctors, oncologists, and through to activists and extraordinary survivors with insights to share. This week, I'm talking to someone from what is now a growing band of nutritionists who are specialising in helping people with cancer. This is a heartening trend driven by some of the specialist courses being run for nutritionists, such as those by Dr. Zandria Williams. Joanne Jackson sidestepped a career in the NHS to answer a need she encountered amongst cancer patients. And now, after retraining, she works as a nutritionist in Cardiff, where I'm talking to her over Skype. Hi, Joanne. Many thanks for coming on the Yes to Life show today.
Thanks for having me.
So, prior to training as a nutritionist, you were working as a radiographer in oncology and as a cancer information officer. Most patients in the UK are still told by their oncologist that nutrition's got little to do with cancer and they recommend a healthy, balanced diet, which, as you realise, means very different things to different people. Anyway, you clearly decided there was more to it than this. What made you decide to change track?
To start with, when I was working as a therapeutic radiographer, I found that I had increasing workloads clinically, and therefore had lack of time to offer psychological support and patient care to the people that I was treating. That led me to work as a cancer information officer at Guy's and St Thomas's. Mm-hmm. And during that time, I was looking after a drop-in cancer information service. A number of the people that came in to speak to me were asking about nutrition advice following conventional treatment for cancer. Yes. And at that time, the hospital dietitians tended to offer specialist diets for people that were on treatment or people that had cachexia, but they were not really fulfilling the needs of people that wanted to change their lifestyle and improve their diet. So there seemed to be a bit of a gap in the care that was offered. So I decided that it was something that interested me, so I decided to retrain.
Step in and fill the gap, brilliant. Okay. Well, despite plenty of resistance, the healthcare environment is changing slowly and increasingly it's embracing lifestyle medicine, as it's referred to now, which includes nutrition and exercise. Now, in your experience, how important is lifestyle medicine in the arena of chronic health conditions, including cancer?
I think for people affected by chronic disease, including cancer, they need to be able to make an informed decision about the treatment options available to them. Often people are feeling very vulnerable and therefore they need support and advice to be empowered and to have some control over the management of their condition. Mm-hmm. And I sort of personally believe that an integrative approach that's tailor-made for the individual, that's holistic, so it addresses more than just the person's physical needs, can be beneficial, and that diet and lifestyle medicine is part of that holistic approach. Alongside conventional medicine, maybe psychological or spiritual support and other complementary therapies. Mm-hmm. I also think there's a role for diet and lifestyle medicine in cancer prevention and obviously for people that have gone through cancer treatment to try and decrease the risk of recurrence or other chronic illness.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that last one you mentioned is possibly the most important area that integrative medicine can help with, because, of course, the rate of recurrence is far, far too high, and there's very few strategies, really, to help people do anything about the fact that they are open to a recurrence.
Yeah, I think it's partly that, and also, obviously, you want to give people the best chance to try and restore their health and to get some quality of life following treatment. And also, I think when people have been feeling very vulnerable, it's an area of their care that they can have some control over and feel empowered to make decisions over those parts of their care. So I think it's important in that.
It's interesting, isn't it, this connection between the kind of psychological empowerment of doing things and also the fact that, say, nutrition or exercise are actually scientifically proven to be valuable. But the effect it can have on the person in terms of their relationship to their own health is very important, isn't it?
I think so. And I think, you know, sort of being able to have strategies to try and counteract some of the effects of the treatments where people have got perhaps weight management issues or fatigue, to try and, you know, sort of be able to reintroduce some kinds of exercise to try and maintain normal body weight or to get back to more normal body weight. And also if somebody's gone past needing a specialist diet, to be able to have, you know, a nutrient dense diet to try and improve their health is important for the longer term picture for that person.
Cancer and cancer treatment, it's enormously complex, the arena, and at times it's hugely challenging as well. I think along the way, nutrition can play many parts in supporting patients and improving outcomes, as you mentioned. From your experience working with people with cancer, what do you find are the areas in which targeted nutrition can be of the very most benefit?
I think there's probably sort of three different areas. As I was just saying, you know, sort of in prevention is part of it, and also for people post conventional treatment to help them to restore their health. There is some value for people in using nutritional medicine alongside conventional treatment to enhance the benefits of it or to lessen the side effects. However, I'd say this is a very complex area, and from the practitioner's perspective, it usually requires a lot of postgraduate type training and experience. And it also needs a collaborative approach with the patient's oncologist. And, you know, when people are undergoing treatment, sometimes they require specialist diets and are looked after by hospital dietitians to try and help with the side effects of their treatment, or if they're suffering from cachexia, obviously the nutritional approach would be different to somebody who's perhaps finished treatment and got over the acute side effects. Yes. My own experience, I tend to work with people after they've had cancer treatments to try and help them to restore their health. And then to look at, you know, sort of how we can try and decrease the risk of recurrence, or just to decrease the risk of chronic disease of a different sort in the longer term. So that's more, you know, the area that I tend to work in rather than while people are undergoing treatment.
Yeah, I understand. So this area is enormously important because, of course, the cancer treatments themselves do take an enormous toll on patients in general.
Yeah, you know, I think sometimes people suffer with long-term effects, particularly fatigue can be a problem. Sometimes, you know, depending on what people are having treated, they can have digestive issues. You know, it very much depends on the type of cancer and the type of treatment that they undergo as to, you know, sort of what kinds of side effects that people struggle with. And what it takes for them to recover from those things. Or sometimes people have to obviously manage their diet and have ongoing health issues relating to their cancer. So it can be quite complex in that way.
Yeah, it is enormously complex. And basically, there's a huge amount to be gained from getting the advice of somebody who has specialised knowledge in this rather than taking a DIY approach. Would you agree?
I think so. I think it's like any nutrition program, there isn't one size fits all. Everybody is individual, so therefore the program needs to be tailor-made to meet that person's needs, and it depends, you know, where they're at in the, you know, sort of experience of having cancer treatment or post-treatment as to what they may need at that particular point in time as well. And I think if fatigue is a problem, it's trying to help by making small changes that are achievable rather than having, you know, sort of a gold standard in your head that is too difficult for somebody to do because they haven't got the energy for it. So, you know, it's definitely easier to work with people on an individual basis. I agree.
And to take an example, I mean, fatigue, of course, does plague an enormous number of people who've been through conventional treatment. It's a very debilitating side effect that basically takes the sparkle out of everything in life. And some people become very depressed as well. Could you just give some examples of the kind of techniques which you're able to offer people who are suffering fatigue?
It depends really on what it is that's causing the fatigue, because, you know, sometimes it could relate to somebody's blood sugar balance, for example. Sometimes it could be to do with the energy production system within the nucleus of the cells, so the building blocks of the body. Sometimes it could be a hormonal related problem. Sometimes it could be due, for example, to do with iron levels and blood loss, you know, so it's kind of it depends from person to person as to what it is that is causing the fatigue. If it's just as a result of the treatment, it's a case of perhaps having enough nutrients within the diet and having, you know, sort of the right quantities of slow-releasing carbohydrate-type foods in conjunction with healthy fats and proteins so that you're giving the person the building blocks for their body to carry out its functions. But it may be a case of working alongside, you know, sort of other therapies to allow people to gradually sort of restore their health. And you know, sometimes these things take time too. So it's, I don't think there's any quick fix answer. And I think because I tend to work with an individual, it's a case of taking a thorough case history and then looking to see what the root causes may be and then working out a plan for that person. So I can't say there's sort of like one particular approach that I would take with people.
Sure, sure. Well, that's a good thing. And of course, that one size fits all is what we've been so used to and hasn't produced such good results in the past. So you mentioned other therapies. Do you cross-refer people to other practitioners if you think a particular kind of therapy would be helpful?
Yes, I do. I'm fortunate. I work sometimes in a clinic that has many different practitioners there. And, you know, sometimes I'll work with somebody that perhaps does psychological support. Sometimes people will use things such as reflexology, homeopathy. So it depends really on the type of health concern the problem the person has as to what may be a good therapy in conjunction with the nutritional therapy. So, yeah, you know, I come from an NHS background and I've always worked in a multidisciplinary team. And I think I'm quite good at identifying when I believe there's a different practitioner that would be well suited for the individual rather than, you know, believing that I can offer everything myself.
Okay, that's great. So I mentioned at the beginning this concept of a healthy, balanced diet. I think, as I say, a lot of people have very different ideas about what that looks like. Just wondered whether you'd like to give us your own version.
Ooh, that's a big question. I think sometimes it comes down to genetics. But without having that information present, I would say for a number of people that I would suggest that having, you know, a diet that's predominantly plant-based, with, if you looked at your plate and split it up into sections, I would say sort of a quarter of it should have a palm-sized portion of something that contains protein. Now, that could be anything from wild oily fish to a grass-fed meat to plant-based proteins like beans or lentils. So that quarter of the plate should have some food that contains protein. The quarter below it, I would say, should have slow-releasing carbohydrate-type foods. That could be root vegetables, squashes, sweet potato, brown rice. And then the other half of the plate, I would say, should be filled with non-starchy vegetables. So anything from greens, salads, peppers, you know, asparagus, whatever you fancy. But you can't really overeat that type of food in terms of the fibre quantity and the calories. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about somebody at the moment, though, that hasn't got a digestive disorder where they've got problems, you know, with a digestive tract, where having that amount of fibre could cause them a problem. I'm talking about somebody, you know, that's not struggling with those kinds of health issues. And also, I think another thing that can be quite helpful is to flavour food with herbs and spices, and then to get the nutritional value of those as well. So I'd say for most people, that kind of balance on a plate would be a healthy diet.
Right. And yeah, the herbs and spices have got a lot of bang for their buck, haven't they? A very little of those goes a long way.
Yes, and I think they're often something that's overlooked, particularly within, you know, sort of a Western diet, whereas perhaps in other types of cuisine, you know, they form a more important part of the recipes that people eat. And I think, you know, likewise, that a lot of people have grown up in an environment where fat has been deemed to be the enemy, and you know, a lot of people follow a low fat diet, and I think more and more so the research seems to be looking towards including healthy fats in the diet. So it's more about, you know, the balance of fats, so perhaps only having 10% saturated fat that you'd get in things like dairy and animal produce, but having, you know, the sort of fats that you'd find in nuts and seeds and olives and oily fish. So, you know, those healthy fats as part of the diet, which is more in keeping with the traditional Mediterranean diet. So, you know, I think we're beginning to perhaps realise why some other cuisines that people eat around the world can be supportive of health. And there's more research being carried out into that.
Yeah, so it is the change in consciousness, the move from carbs to fat, is just beginning to really bite in terms of the public, isn't it? There seems to be a wider understanding that that whole direction of trying to remove fat altogether was not such a good idea for our health.
No, I think removing any food group, you know, entirely for most people isn't really good for health. So I think, like most things, like probably the elderly members of the family would say that everything in moderation. I think there's probably something in that. And eating things in their natural form and cooking from scratch and eating, you know, foods that are preferably sort of locally produced and rich in nutrients. There's a lot to be said for that as well. Seasonal produce, you know, so trying to get the most nutrient-dense food possible, in terms of, you know, where it travels from and how it's stored and how it's cooked. I think they all have a level of importance as well, especially for people that have got chronic disease or have had chronic disease, so that, you know, when you choose food, it's about sort of the value of the food and not just the calories.
Right. Okay, thank you. So diet and cancer, they've been linked for about a century, since Max Gerson developed his dietary therapy. But up to now, diet's always been relegated to the alternative camp. But one diet mm-hmm. has recently started to be taken seriously by the mainstream, and that is the ketogenic diet, They're running some trials on that in relation to cancer right now. So what's your take on the diet, and do you use it or aspects of it in your practice?
I think there's, for some people, there's certainly a benefit of ketogenic diets. I know there's research to support its use, and I think some of the research I first looked at was for children that had uncontrolled epilepsy. So, you know, there is research out there that supports its use in some, you know, health conditions. It's not something that I feel like I have enough postgraduate experience in that I would actively, you know, sort of offer that type of diet to people. If I have people that contact me that specifically want a ketogenic diet, I tend to refer them to a nutritional therapist who works in an integrative practice whose main focus is research into ketogenic diets. So he's very keen to take on people that want to follow that type of diet. So I think, like anything, if it's something that's very specialist and somebody's got an area of interest in that, that there's times to refer people on to the person that specialises. But I can see its value. I'm not sure that it suits everybody. I think if you consider sort of the genetic testing as well, that some people are better suited to that type of diet if they're doing it, for example, for weight loss or sports performance rather than for having a health issue. But yeah, I think it's one of those areas where, again, there's more emerging research evidence, and it's something that I'm keen to follow and to know more about.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that the move in that direction is influencing your practice in some way, though?
Not really. It's not something that I get asked about very often. It's probably happened a handful of times when I've then referred the person on to somebody else, but maybe it depends where you're located. I'm located in Cardiff in Wales, and yeah. I think sometimes there's a bit of a time delay between what happens perhaps in the southeast and what happens in Wales, so maybe I've got a bit of time on my side to understand more of the research and get to grips with it before it comes my way.
Okay, fair enough. So another area where mainstream science is beginning to cross over into the preserve of complementary and alternative medicine is gut health. More and more aspects of our general health are being ascribed to the microbiome, and immunity is notable amongst these when it comes to cancer, which you could, of course, describe as simply a failure of the immune system to deal with damaged cells appropriately. Firstly, what are the aspects of modern lifestyle that you think are contributing the most to poor gut health?
I think there's a number of things. In terms of, if you look at sort of a lot of chronic illnesses, I think there's inflammation involved in them. And so I think that certain types of food, alcohol, stress can all, you know, sort of add to the systemic inflammation that's caused. I think there's definitely a link between the food choices people make, the gut bacteria, and the immune system. So for example, if people eat a lot of refined carbohydrates, so, you know, the sweet treats, the cakes, the biscuits, white baked goods, and replace them with more whole foods, then this can improve the diversity of the gut bacteria, so the gut microbiome changes. So I think having a diet that's highly processed can cause a problem with the gut bacteria, and then the knock-on effects with an inflammatory response, and then this can suppress the immune system. And by replacing those processed foods with, you know, foods that are cooked from scratch using whole foods can be beneficial. But I think there's other factors that come into it. So people's mindset, relaxation, sleep quality, the environment all have an effect on the immune system. So I think it's not just being blinkered and considering everything from a nutrition perspective. I also speak to people very much about sort of lifestyle factors, because if they're, for example, under long-term stress, it may be that looking at stress management techniques would have more leverage than just nutritional changes.
Right.
So I'm quite a fan of Dr. Chatterjee's four-pillar plan, you know, where he considers the sleep, the relaxation, the nutrition and the exercise as all being important.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah. And just to turn to what you're saying about the environment having an effect here, in what ways would you think particularly?
Well, part of it I'd say is in terms of people's toxic load. So, for example, if you're eating foods that are not organic, so you could be taking in toxins in that way. Part of it could be, you know, environmental pollution. Part of it is things like being exposed to chemicals from, say, BPA, from plastics. So, you know, sometimes it's the environmental factors that people are exposed to, as well as obviously the lifestyle choices people make, like drinking alcohol and smoking cigarettes. So, you know, they're all going to have an effect on gut health, but also on immunity. You know, I'd say your digestive system, if it functions well, is part of your ability to detoxify. Mm-hmm. So if you've got issues with your digestive system, then your ability to break down those toxins. And obviously, as we age, we're all exposed to toxins. So therefore, you know, it's something that if you can improve your digestive health, it can help with that system.
Mm. Right. And one of the things that I grew up with was the idea that life is full of germs and we must use lots of strong chemicals to kill them all off. This is coming into question these days. And of course, this is the stuff, talking about environment, this is the environment of our home and what we do in that. How do you feel about what would have been considered hygiene, but maybe it's getting a rebrand?
I think if you look at sort of your immune system and how it develops, you know, some of it happens before you're even born and some of it's during, you know, the process of being born and being exposed to a range of bacterial microbes, you know, as a young child can help to prepare your immune system to be able to tackle those things in later life. So I think this idea that everybody needs to have antibacterial everything could maybe be more detrimental rather than useful. So I think perhaps for my children's generation, where it's very much, you know, everything needed to be washed in antibacterial cleaner, that perhaps we're going full circle and realizing that on some level, a little bit of exposure to some bacteria, so you gradually prime your immune system, can be a good thing. I guess it depends on your age and what it is that you're being exposed to as to whether it causes health issues,
yes,
or not. But yeah, I think, you know, when we were children and we were able to play outside and perhaps get a little bit dirty, I don't think for most people it was actually detrimental to health. I think they're now starting to realise it was actually beneficial.
Mm. I think I read a study about comparing children who'd grown up with pets as against ones who hadn't, and the ones with the pets definitely were healthier.
Yeah, I know the research you're talking about, but yeah, I think there's evidence to show that playing with pets, it does help part of that, you know, sort of building your immune system.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there are many reasons that diet and lifestyle medicine have been sidelined. The main one has to be the profit motive that drives Western healthcare. But another one has been the understanding of what cancer actually is and how it works. Genetics have been the exclusive focus of research for decades, and genetic theory could explain cancer without the need to examine lifestyle factors. That is until epigenetics hit the scene a little while ago. Lifestyle medicine, and particularly things like ketogenics, rely on a very different interpretation of cancer, the 100-year-old metabolic theory. So these two theories have been seen as being in opposition to one another. Do you think it's a case of one being right and the other wrong, or do you think both contain part of the picture?
If I'm honest, I don't know. I think both contain part of the picture, in as much that the traditional view that it's a genetic disease and there's damage to the DNA within the nucleus of the cell, and therefore some normal cells can potentially transform into cancerous cells. You know, I think there's some truth in that, and maybe it's to do with the immune system and the loss of the ability to have, you know, to be able to kill off those cancerous cells. But also this theory of looking at the mitochondria within cells and them being responsible for cellular metabolism and respiration. There is obviously some element of energy metabolism, and perhaps cancer management should look at sort of therapies that target cell energy metabolism and not just looking at how the DNA changes. So I don't know. I think it's like anything, it's like looking at immunotherapy, as in it's trying to find a way to combat what's changing within those cells. To date, you know, a lot of the therapies have existed since, well, probably post-Second World War, some of them. They've evolved and improved over time, but in essence, we're still using the same kind of cancer treatments. Being able to use things like immunotherapy as being a more modern advance, maybe there needs to be a lot more research into looking at the energy metabolism in cells and whether there's therapies that can target that, if that hypothesis is correct. But I don't know. You know, I don't know whether there's sufficient proof that there is, whether that research is being done. Like all of these things, it takes a lot of time to understand them and to develop therapies that could be used on people.
Well, there does seem to be an increase in interest in the metabolic area, which is heartening, because I think they're missing a huge trick by not approaching those things. I mean, the example, say, of the repurposed drugs that are being used, which, you know, cheap, low toxicity drugs that happen to target the energy systems of cancer cells, and this being done alongside whatever therapy is being carried on, not making any difference to the treatment program, but just adding a few pounds, literally, to the cost to target the energy systems. And it looks like preliminary results in this area are looking very good. So I'm very happy this is happening, because, I mean, the one thing about targeting the metabolism rather than the genes is that the genes seem to be a continually moving target, which, you know sooner start to think you're getting the upper hand then the target moves. And, you know, if you don't apply another very expensive targeted treatment, then, you know, off it goes again. But the metabolism, mm-hmm. well, it's its energy system. It needs that come what may.
Sure. Yeah, no, I think there's definitely scope to try and look at therapies that can specifically target the tumour cell energy metabolism as well. You know, I think it's something that more work needs to be done to see whether that makes a difference. And as you say, if those therapies are not having the same side effects as some other therapies and they don't cost that much money, then it looks like an area that's worth exploring, doesn't it?
So it does. Okay. There's a spectrum of nutritionists around that range from those who depend heavily on supplements to help their clients, right across to those who are always in favour of food and will only resort to supplements in a few circumstances. I'm interested to know where on this spectrum you stand and why.
I think in my mind, I nearly always start with food with people. I think the word supplement means that it should supplement food. It shouldn't be a replacement. So I think my fear sometimes is that people will continue maybe to not have the best diet and rely on supplements instead. I think there's a place for supplements when people cannot get all the nutrients they need from their diet. Sometimes when people are either too unwell or post-surgery, for example, it may be difficult for them to eat sufficient food or the right type of food to get the nutrients that they need. There's some nutrients, for example, you know, if you live in the Northern Hemisphere for part of the year, not at the moment, it can be hard to get enough vitamin D because we don't get enough exposure on our skin to make it, you know, through our skin, and you can't get that much from food. So, you know, there's a place sometimes to use supplements to top up what people can obtain from food. And I think the other time that supplements are good are if somebody is particularly deficient in a nutrient, and it would be difficult to add direction to the diet to give them enough of that nutrient without giving them a really bizarre sort of skewed, you know, list of foods to eat, then, you know, there's a place for supplements in that way. And I sometimes use them with people, for example, if I think they would benefit from having more essential fatty acids, but they really dislike the foods that contain the nutrients that they need, then a supplement can be used instead if they're not willing to eat those foods. So I tend to start with foods and then see whether following, you know, sort of the first steps, whether supplements would be beneficial in addition to what the person's eating.
Right, right. Okay, well, I said in last week's show that it seems to me that testing is what's brought naturopathic and nutritional medicine into the 21st century. We've moved from, like, try some of this and it might help, to knowing when there's a deficiency that needs addressing in a particular way and being able to do specifically the right thing to correct it. What's your take on testing, and what tests do you favour, if any, and do you rely on them routinely?
I don't rely on them routinely, so I don't say to everybody that comes in for consultation they need testing. Right. Sometimes it can be helpful for people to identify if they've got imbalances or, for example, pathogens present, and the test results can be used in conjunction with the clinical picture from, you know, sort of collecting the person's data during the consultation. So I don't just look at test results and make decisions based solely on those. Sometimes they're quite good if people have tried lots of things themselves prior to coming for a consultation. And they're kind of at their wit's end and they want some answers more quickly. So it's a good way to get to what the underlying cause may be, rather than just sort of, as you say, randomly trying things to see whether it makes a difference. I'd say probably the most common types of tests I use are things like stool analysis, to look at what's going on within the digestive system, whether people are able to digest food and absorb it properly, whether there's any parasites present, what the balance of the bacteria within the gut is, you know, sort of whether there's raised inflammatory markers. So that's a test that is quite commonly used. Sometimes if people think they've got some kind of yeast overgrowth because of the symptoms they've got, you can specifically test just for sort of an overgrowth of yeast, but more often than not would look at an overall sort of comprehensive stool analysis. Sometimes people find having an adrenal stress test useful if they're suffering with their energy, to look to see what's happening throughout the 24 hours to see, you know, what their stress hormones are like and whether it's affecting their circadian rhythm. Sometimes people want thyroid type testing done because perhaps they've had quite a limited test carried out and it's useful to have more markers tested to see if there's, for example, an autoimmune element because they've got raised antibodies. So there's, you know, there's various different tests I use with people, but I don't always suggest testing the first time I meet with people. It can be a case if I think there's straightforward tweaks that could be made to their nutrition or lifestyle that would start with those and then look and review, you know, sort of symptoms and then decide whether testing would be beneficial after that. But as you say, it's much easier then to get sort of the biochemistry and use data to make decisions rather than just trying something to see if it works. So, but budget comes into it as well, whether people have, you know, the finance to pay for functional lab tests in addition to paying for, you know, consultations and the food that they need. So that's obviously part of the deciding factor.
Yes, I was going to ask about that side of it. Do you find in general that patients are accepting of the kind of costs that are involved in testing these days, and are the costs going down?
I think there's, in the last, I'd say, 2 or 3 years, I've become much more aware of there being more testing companies out there. And because of that, I'd say that the cost of the tests are decreasing. From my perspective, it's obviously always important to look at whether there's the same reliability of the tests, and it's not just whether they cost less. But I think that there are some very good companies out there now that seem to be providing, you know, sort of reliable results, but a more affordable price. So it's more accessible to, you know, a number of clients than it perhaps was when I first qualified 6 years ago.
Mm. And something like a stool analysis, you mentioned it, gives quite a detailed picture, really, of many aspects of a person's health, really, in one go, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's good if somebody comes with digestive type symptoms. So it can give you a little bit of a window into what may be happening at the various points through the digestive tract. So it allows, you know, sort of certain things to be ruled out as perhaps being the underlying causes of the problem. One thing I would stress, though, is if somebody came to me with symptoms that I would describe as red flag symptoms that could be indicative of something more serious going on with their health, is I would always refer them back to their doctor to have a discussion about those things. And sometimes people have already had testing done through the NHS before they come to me to rule out other diagnosable conditions. So I think it's important, you know, to stress that as a nutritional therapist, we're not there to offer a substitute for medical advice.
Right. Okay. Now, I imagine that you're frustrated, like me, by the glacial pace of change in mainstream cancer care when it comes to adopting simple, cheap lifestyle interventions that have got the potential to help, sometimes to help more than some of the very expensive drugs that are being used. But having been inside and outside the NHS, what do you think are the main roadblocks to change? And is there anything more that we can do to speed things up?
I think part of the problem is there's perhaps a lack of awareness of the research evidence that does exist. Mm-hmm. As well as there being a limited amount of research, I think there is research, but sometimes people are not aware of the research evidence being there. And I think there's also this issue that the randomized controlled trial model seems to be considered to be the gold standard, and that doesn't lend itself particularly well to nutrition and lifestyle medicine. So I think it's again looking at the efficacy of research and people taking on board, you know, sort of what kinds of research needs to be carried out depending on the type of study. I think there's also this issue that, you know, most drug type research is funded by large pharmaceutical companies. So a lot of it comes down to money. And with nutrition, you know, who's going to fund the research? And some of the nutrition research I have looked at, again, there seems to be a conflict of interest between the funding coming from the food industry.
Right.
So again, it's trying to work out whether it's flawed or biased because of them trying to sell a product. So I think there's still an issue in the same way with pharmaceutical companies that happens, you know, with nutrition, which doesn't help. But I think the other thing is that there's a lack of nutrition training. in medical training. And I know, again, that Dr. Chatterjee is trying to address this by offering some basic, you know, nutrition medicine training to GPs. But I think, you know, across the board, if people could understand the relevance and the use of nutrition and lifestyle medicine within oncology and other types of medicine, it would really help. And I think, you know, there seems to be a time delay between the research evidence that's out there and it influencing public health policy. So by the time that they update with a sacking report, then, you know, the research has moved on. So in terms of trying to improve it, I guess it's a case of trying to educate health professionals more about the benefits of nutrition and lifestyle medicine, to work in collaboration with other healthcare practitioners, to be able to, with the specialist knowledge, to be able to work within an NHS setting and support patients in hospitals and primary care, and not just leave it to centres such as when I worked in the Richard Dimbleby Cancer Information Support Service or in Maggie centres, you know, to actually get it within the hospital, to try and raise people's awareness of the research exists and also to try and build upon that research. So I think, you know, there's a long way to go, but there's a lot of work that could be done to improve it.
It's kind of tragic. I mean, you know, by any standards, we have an absolutely urgent situation in terms of chronic disease, and people representing the NHS will be the first to say that. And there are quite a raft of cheap resources out there with, as you say, the science is there already behind it, which could be used right now. They don't need any time to rev up or anything, you know. But it's this enormous time lag of resistance, it seems like, to change, basically, which is, yeah, it's absolutely terrible in terms of the need of the population. I appreciate what you said about the funding for trials, and that's right. There can be just the same kind of problems around nutritional research as there are around pharmaceuticals. But these are the reasons why one would hope that either the government or charity would step in and fund these things. Because, I mean, Cancer Research UK, massive budget for research, but how much is going in nutrition? You know, is it 1% even? I doubt it. And, you know, the government similarly had an opportunity to fund research into repurposed drugs recently, and they filibustered it, so they made sure it didn't go through. So, you know, these things are being stymied at every step, and the people we should be able to depend on to push these things through as quickly as possible, i.e. the government or charities, are not doing it, unfortunately. So you mentioned there about the unsuitability of the gold standard of research to, like, nutritional medicine, for example. Do you have any thoughts on what a suitable type of measure for scientific success would be for lifestyle medicine?
I think it's always difficult because a lot of the research tends to rely on people, say, completing food diaries, and is retrospective, and therefore I'm never quite sure about the reliability of some of those studies. But also there's this element that if it's carried out within a clinical setting, whether it's really reflective of what happens in everyday life. Yes. And I think it's like any kind of research, that if it's not, it's more sort of qualitative, so it's harder to measure. So
Yeah, it's an issue for sure. But I mean, there's interesting new model has emerged in the area of diabetes, which is that the diabetes patients themselves have got together, created their own website, and actually they've all got on and changed their diet and reversed their diabetes and recorded it. And at a certain point, you've got anecdotal evidence to the max. You know, you've got so much of it, you simply can't ignore it. Whether there was a lab there or not, you've simply got a volume of evidence that is shouting, look, take a look at this, wake up. And I think something along those lines has got the flavour of now, you know, this is the way things work nowadays, is that, you know, you get your evidence for whether a torch works or not from other people who bought that torch. Real world evidence from real people who've really done it and got one and found out it was useless or it was fantastic. And, you know, and if enough people say it's fantastic, you will have a lot of confidence in buying one for yourself. And I don't see why we can't apply a similar principle in medicine. At present, we don't even ask the patient whether they were satisfied with the treatment, whether it worked for them. It's only looked at from the outside, objectively, and we're told whether it's been successful or not.
I think practitioners themselves tend to work more in that way, as in we tend to use, you know, things like McCore or MyMOP type ratings, where people themselves score the point where they start and then evaluate their treatment through, you know, using those tools again at a later date. And I think there's definitely a place. I've been working with somebody developing an app for people that have thyroid disorders. And the idea of the app is that the medication, the person can be reminded of their medication, they can record the medication that they take, but they can also note quite easily sort of what symptoms they're suffering. But there's also an element within it that they can get dietary advice and can look to see, you know, is there a pattern between how they're feeling and the amount of exercise they've done or what they've been eating. Right. And the idea is that when they go to consultations within a clinical setting, they'll have a diary of, you know, sort of what medication they took at what time, how they were feeling on that day, whether they'd slept, whether they'd eaten, whether they'd done any exercise, how it affects their mood. So obviously lots of valuable data, but using technology in an app form like Butterfly would be really helpful to hopefully for the person themselves with the condition, but also for the health professionals taking care of them. But, you know, with permission to be able to then use that data would give a huge wealth of valuable, you know, data that could be analysed to see how all of those things interrelate.
Mm. So that's interesting. It works on two levels. It works on the personal level, helping that person, but also their data helps the overall picture for everybody else. So, yeah, brilliant.
Mm. Yeah.
All right. So, look, we're out of time. Thanks very much indeed for talking to today, Joanne. Been very interesting. I want to reiterate to our Welsh listeners that you are actually in Cardiff. There are not so many nutritionists who are supporting people with cancer out in your direction. So it's good to know you're there. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Do take a look at Joanne's website, Whole Nutrition. You can find links to it and to other material related to the show on the Yes to Life website. Just go to yestolife.org.uk and click the Yes to Life show logo on the homepage. A new event just posted to the Yes to Life calendar is a Walida Skincare and Pamper workshop on the 19th of July in London. Walida is a great company. I visited it myself and seen the way they grow the ingredients biodynamically and the care with which the products are made. So do take advantage of this opportunity. Be sure to book soon though, as I'm sure places will fill quickly. And another reminder that if you're a runner or a would-be runner, to sign up to support Yes to Life in this year's 10K run in Victoria Park, London on the 6th of October. Please join me again next week for another Yes to Life show. Goodbye.